So welcome back. We complete tonight chapter 26, The Ascent Towards Supermind. How to integrate, how to suffuse and transform the dark origins of the universe is really the question before Sri Aurobindo. It's the nature of the cosmic riddle, which he met in his own sadhana, being one with the world and finding that again and again that an intractable resistance would be met each time that he brought a great light into mind, life, and matter. He had to analyze and understand it to its depths, and he's bringing this to the front now. Just how challenging is this endeavor to ascend towards the supermind, to get to the higher ranges of consciousness, how to import their luminosity and their energy and their power into the active cosmos that we live in, was all the work. And of course, he throws it out here in philosophic terms, but it's based upon his actual experience. Never-ending actual experience, because he worked on this essentially as a challenge from the time he came to Pondicherry in 1910 until he left his body about 40 years later in 1950. So it was interesting that we closed last time with an allusion to World War II as a comparison to how we might be able to see or understand the challenge before us. We'll continue now. This entails certain consequences which modify the clear successions of the evolution and prevent it from following the cleanly determined and firmly arranged course which our logical intelligence demands from nature but seldom gets from her. As life and mind begin to appear when the organization of matter is sufficient to admit them. But the more complex and perfect organization of matter comes with the evolution of life and mind. As mind appears, when life is sufficiently organized to admit of a developed vibration of consciousness. But life receives its full organization and development only after mind can act upon it. As the spiritual evolution begins, when man as mind is capable of the movements of spirituality, but mind also rises to its own highest perfection by the growth of the intensities and luminosities of the spirit. So it is with this higher evolution of the ascending powers of the spirit. So each rung that we're advancing from only finds its fulfillment when the next above begins to lean into it, begins to impart its glow into it. And this continues. This process is replicated from level to level, and he is not abrogating it from the rise to the supramental consciousness also. He thinks that this movement of nature is part of the evolutionary plan embedded in the cosmos. As soon as there is a sufficient spiritual development, something of intuition, illumination of the being, the movements of the higher spiritual grades of consciousness begins to manifest. Sometimes one, sometimes the other, or all together, and they do not wait for each power in the series to complete itself before a higher power comes into action. An overmind light and power may descend in some sort, create a partial form of itself in the being, and take a leading part or supervise or intervene while the intuitive and illumining mind and higher mind are still incomplete. These would then remain in the whole, acting along with a greater power often penetrated or sublimated by it, arising into it to form a greater or overmind intuition, a greater or overmind illumination, a greater or overmind spiritual thinking. So he's depicting here again how the higher will act upon the lower to bring it to its rounded perfection, what's possible. This intricate action takes place because each descending power, by its intensity of pressure on the nature and uplifting effect, makes the being already capable of a still higher invasion before that earlier power itself is complete in its self-formation. So you can see this is sort of the edge of the advance, cutting through space, cutting through air, and the rest will follow. But there's this preliminary movement. The illumination and the higher thought need the help of the intuition. The intuition needs the help of the overmind to combat the darkness or ignorance in which they labor and to give them their own fullness. Still, it is not possible in the end for the overmind status and integration to be complete until the higher mind and the illumined mind have been integrated and taken up into the intuition, and the intuition itself subsequently integrated and taken up into the all-enlarging and all-sublimating overmind energy. The law of the gradation has to be satisfied even in the complexity of the process of evolutionary nature. This is the first of three complexities that he deals with. So we must draw from the higher level for an enforcing fullness. And the overmind can't find its fulfillment without a full integration of these lesser lights. So is it feasible then, without this all being accomplished, to regard it as a possibility to supramentalize the nature? He seems not to even approach the topic. Much to be done. A further cause of complexity arises from the need of integration itself. So if the first was the complexity of process, this is one about integration. For the process is not only an ascent of the soul to a higher status, but a descent of the higher consciousness so gained to take up and transform the inferior nature. But this nature has a density of previous formation which resists and obstructs the descent. Even when the higher power has broken the barrier and descended and is at work, we have seen that the nature of the ignorance resists and obstructs the working, that it either strives to refuse transformation altogether or tries to modify the new power into some conformity with its own workings, or even throws itself upon it to seize and degrade and enslave it to its own way of action and lower purpose. Ordinarily, in their task of assumption and assimilation of this difficult stuff of nature, the higher powers descend first into the mind and occupy the mind centers because these are nearest to themselves in intelligence and knowledge power. If they descend first into the heart or into the vital being of force and sensation, as they sometimes do because these happen to be in some individuals more open and call them first, the results are more mixed and dubious, imperfect and insecure than if things happen in the logical order. But even in its normal working, when it takes up the being part by part in the natural order of descent, the descending power is not able to bring about a total occupation and transformation of each before it goes farther. It can only affect a general and incomplete occupation, so that the workings of each remain still partly of the new, higher, partly of a mixed, partly of the old, unchanged, lower order. All the mind in its whole range cannot be transmuted at once, for the mind centers are not a region isolated from the rest of the being. The mind action is penetrated by the action of the vital and physical parts, and in those parts themselves are lower formations of mind, a vital mind, a physical mind, and these have to be changed before there can be an entire transformation of the mental being. So you see the complexity that he's describing here. The higher transforming power has, therefore, to descend as soon as may be and without waiting for an integral mental change into the heart so as to occupy and change the emotional nature, and afterwards into the inferior vital centers to occupy and change the whole vital and kinetic and sensational nature, and finally into the physical centers so as to occupy and change the whole physical nature. So the descent has come into the mind, it has proceeded into the heart, into the vital, and it goes farther. But even this finality is not final, for there are still left the subconscient parts and the inconscient foundation. So all this, in a sense, must be penetrated by this descent for any of it to be one. Huh. Now we can grasp the immensity of the project. So these have to come into all these intervening and interconnecting levels, and there are many. The intricacy, the interwoven action of these powers and parts of the being is so great that it may almost be said that in this change, nothing is accomplished until all is accomplished. In fact, Sri Aurobindo writes this in his letters and his correspondence more than once, makes this notation. There is a tide and ebb, the forces of the old nature receding, and again partially occupying their old dominions, effectuating a slow retreat with rear-line actions and return attacks and aggressions, the higher influx occupying each time more conquered territory, but imperfectly sure of sovereignty so long as anything is left that has not become part of its luminous regime. So again, an allusion to the war effort going on in the world as he wrote this. The give and take. It's the old battle of light and darkness at this level. A third complexity is brought in by the power of the consciousness to live in more than one status at a time. Especially, a difficulty is created by the division of our being into an inner and an outer or surface nature, and the farther intricacy of a secret circumconscient or environmental consciousness in which are determined our unseen connections with the world outside us. Unseen because we don't normally attend to that. We're not watching how this part of our being interfaces, connects with the larger world from the interior domains. To have that, you have to have some knowledge, some awareness of the subliminal being to see where the screening of the individual ends and where the wider world begins to come in. In the spiritual opening, it is the awakened inner being that readily receives and assimilates the higher influences and puts on the higher nature. The external surface self, more entirely molded by the forces of the ignorance and inconscience, is slower to awake, slower to receive, slower to assimilate. There is therefore a long stage in which the inner being is sufficiently transformed, but the outer is still involved in a mixed and difficult movement of imperfect change. So we see this in the practice of yoga often in ourselves, that some part of us continues to answer the call of the old nature, while other parts of us inside are fully ready, able to go on, but they can't advance farther at the moment because this rear guard action has to be quelled and converted. This disparity, he says, repeats itself at each step of the ascent, for in each change, the inner being follows more readily. The outer limps after, reluctant or else incompetent in spite of its aspiration and desire. This necessitates a constantly repeated labor of assumption, adaptation, orientation, a labor reproduced in new terms always, but always the same in principle. And no one ought to accuse themselves of villainy in this regard. This is the nature of the cosmos and of the stuff that we've agreed to deal with in our lives, individually, in collective yoga, and in the world's general advance. Sri Aurobindo was working on these very issues from the time he launched this difficult sadhana in Pondicherry early after his return or his arrival there in 1910. And he noted it frequently. But even when the outer and inner nature of the individual are unified in a harmonized spiritual consciousness, that still more external but occult part of him in which his being mixes with the being of the outside world and through which the outside world invades his consciousness remains a field of imperfection. There is necessarily a commerce here between disparate influences. The inner spiritual influence is met by quite opposite influences, strong in their control of the present world order. The new spiritual consciousness has to bear the shock of the dominant and established unspiritualized powers of the ignorance. This creates a difficulty which is of capital importance in all stages of the spiritual evolution and its urge towards a change of the nature. A subjective spirituality can be established which refuses or minimizes commerce with the world, or is content to witness its action and throw back or throw out its invading influences without allowing any reaction to them or admitting their intrusion. But if the inner spirituality is to be objectivized in a free world action, if the individual has to project himself into the world and, in a sense, take the world into himself, this cannot be dynamically done without receiving the world influences through one's own circumconscient or environmental being. And for us to be successful in this yoga, we must be in commerce with the world. The spiritual inner consciousness has then to deal with these influences in such a way that as soon as they approach or enter, they become either obliterated and without result, or transformed by their very entry into its own mode and substance. Or it may force them to receive the spiritual influence and return with a transforming power on the world they come from. For such a compulsion on the lower universal nature is part of a perfect spiritual action. So either when they come, they're dissolved. Simply, they're gone. Or they're transformed. Or we send them back, we take them, we accept them, turn them into a luminous energy and send them back out. There's a conversion. The one is refusal. The one is acceptance. You simply receive it and it's transformed within you. The third is that you're charging it with a force and returning it into the world. You see, those are the three possibilities if the consciousness is powerful enough. But for that, the circumconscient or environmental being must be so steeped in the spiritual light and spiritual substance that nothing can enter into it without undergoing this transformation. The invading external influences have not to bring in at all their lower awareness, their lower sight, their lower dynamism. But this is a difficult perfection, because ordinarily the circumconscient is not wholly our own formed and realized self, but our self plus the external world nature. And remember, the circumconscient is that encircling area of our conscious being in which we interface with the wider cosmos. That's why he often calls it the environmental being as well, because it's that of us which extends out and connects to the outer world. And you might say that this is the interface of the self and the world. The circumconscient is the interface. And so it's a confluence of both things. You might say it's where the salt water of the ocean meets the pure water of the stream and becomes, in a sense, brackish. It becomes neither nor, or both and. It is for this reason always easier to spiritualize the inner self-sufficient parts than to transform the outer action. Yes, easier to do the internal work than to rebound upon the world with the force that changes it. A perfection of introspective, indwelling, or subjective spirituality aloof from the world or self-protected against it is easier than a perfection of the whole nature in a dynamic, kinetic spirituality objectivized in the life, embracing the world, master of its environment, sovereign in its commerce with world nature. But this is the definition of the integral yoga. This is the definition of the one who has fulfillment in the practice of yoga. But since the integral transformation must embrace fully the dynamic being and take up into it the life of action and the world self outside us, this completer change is demanded of the evolving nature. Evolution is itself incomplete if this is not accomplished in the aspiring universalized individual. The essential difficulty comes from the fact that the substance of our normal being is molded out of the inconscience. Our ignorance is a growth of knowledge in a substance of being which is nescient. So remember, from the superconscient, there's this long chain of involution which results in the inconscience. That's the mooring from which we begin. We rise from that. And ignorance itself is an effort of being to rise out of the inconscient and move towards knowledge. Even though it is still ignorance, it is a vast movement of knowledge by comparison with the blackness from which it comes. Our ignorance is a growth of knowledge and a substance of being which is nescient. Nescient means absent of knowledge. The consciousness it develops, the knowledge it establishes, are always dogged, penetrated, enveloped by this nescience. So the whole range of the worlds of ignorance, matter, life, mind, are never free of this originating inconscient influence. It is this substance of nescience that has to be transformed into a substance of superconscience, a substance in which consciousness and a spiritual awareness are always there, even when they are not active, not expressed, not put into form of knowledge. So this is a mighty light indeed that can take the substance of nescience and make it a substance of superconscience. In other words, it has such a transforming power that it can convert what it touches into what it came from. It can transform its matrix. Till that is done, the nescience invades or encompasses or even swallows up and absorbs into its oblivious darkness all that enters into it. It compels the descending light to compromise with the lesser light it enters. There is a mixture, a diminution and dilution of itself, a diminution, a modification, an incomplete authenticity of its truth and power. It would be too easy to compare this to the phenomenon of black holes in modern physics and how light disappears into it, but if you like metaphors, have at it. Or at the least, the nescience limits its truth and circumscribes its force, segments its applicability and its range. Its truth of principle is barred from a full truth of individual realization or from an achieved truth of cosmic practice. So until this nescience is overcome by a powerful enough light descending from above, it continues to operate and make imperfect the best results of the individual, luminous though he may be, and certainly of the cosmic extension. So the cosmic purpose cannot be fulfilled, and the individual destiny cannot be completed until there is the descent of a light that can transform nescience. So no intervening light can do it. Overmind, intuition, illumined mind, higher mind. Nothing is powerful enough to transform the nescience. It manages to diminish, dilute, and all these other things, to subjugate eventually the light to its own doing. All is swallowed into that darkness. Thus, love, as a law of life, can affirm itself practically as an inner active principle. But unless it occupies the whole substance of being, the entire individual feeling and action cannot be molded by the law of love. Even if perfected in the individual, it can be rendered unilateral and ineffective by the general nescience, which is blind to it and hostile. Or it is forced to circumscribe its range of cosmic application. A full action in harmony with the new law of the being is always difficult in human nature. For in the substance of the inconscience, there is a self-protective law of blind imperative necessity which limits the play of the possibilities that emerge from it or enter into it and prevents them from establishing their free action and result, or realizing the intensity of their own absolute. A mixed, relative, curbed, and diminished play is all that is conceded to them. Otherwise, they would cancel the frame of inconscience and violently perturb without effectively changing the basis of the world order. For none of them have in their mental or vital play the divine power to replace this dark original principle and organize a totally new world order. And so, the descent of the pranic world, the descent of the mental lights, however grand and phalanx they may be, are insufficient to answer this cosmic question. We must go higher. The ascent to the supermind must be complete. A transformation of human nature can only be achieved when the substance of the being is so steeped in the spiritual principle that all its movements are a spontaneous dynamism and a harmonized process of the spirit. But even when the higher powers and their intensities enter into the substance of the inconscient, they are met by this blind opposing necessity and are subjected to this circumscribing and diminishing law of the nescient substance. It opposes them with its strong titles of an established and inexorable law, meets always the claim of life with the law of death, the demand of light with the need of a relief of shadow and a background of darkness, the sovereignty and freedom and dynamism of the spirit with its own force of adjustment by limitation, demarcation by incapacity, foundation of energy on the repose of an original inertia. And those of you who have read the vast cosmic compendium, which is his epic poem, Savitri, have met this in verse again and again and again. With each reading, you'll find him dealing with these very obstinate questions. There is an occult truth behind its negations, which only the supermind, with its reconciliation of contraries and the original reality, can take up and so discover the pragmatic solution of the enigma. Because the supermental is a consciousness drawing upon the fundamental reality of Satchit Ananda, the conscious existent whose nature is delight, it alone can harmonize and reconcile all contraries. It's all there, waiting to be discovered. Only the supramental force can entirely overcome this difficulty of the fundamental nescience, for with it enters an opposite and luminous imperative necessity, which underlies all things and is the original and final self-determining truth force of the self-existent infinite. If there is a necessity operating here in this world and seems always to give us the eternal no, there is an eternal yes, an affirmation that descends from above with the full light of Satchitananda through the portal of supramind into matter here. That is what transforms. This greater luminous spiritual necessity and its sovereign imperative alone can displace or entirely penetrate, transform into itself, and so replace the blind ananke of the inconscience. Yes. Self-determining truth force, Ritta Chit of Sat, Ananke, the Greek term, and you've been waiting for it because obviously the appearance of necessity again and again in this chapter is a reference back to early Greek philosophy, early Greek mythology. Necessity, Ananke, is she who controls all things, even fate. Is a determination that she throws and releases into the cosmos. And she is this serpentine goddess who twins her action with another serpent called Kronos, the uncoiling of time, to form the dimensionality of the universe, and all comes into being because of her. Sri Aurobindo's position is that obviously, since this is a result of that, when that descends here, Purnam Madaha Purnam Idam, that whole shloka that we chant every time, that is full, this is full. When that descends here, this will be fulfilled. A supramental change of the whole substance of the being, and therefore necessarily of all its characters, powers, movements, takes place when the involved supermind in nature emerges to meet and join with the supramental light and power descending from supernature. So it's already here. All of Satchit-Ananda is always here. The supramental is here as well, waking to be stirred, waiting to be stirred from within. And the supramental, as it approaches from above, calls to it, stirs it into wakefulness. And when they meet in that nexus, ah, there's the moment. There's the moment. The individual must be the instrument and first field of the transformation. But an isolated individual transformation is not enough and may not be wholly feasible. I pause because when the mother brought down the supramental into the Earth atmosphere, she called it a supramental manifestation. She decidedly said that it was not a descent into her being, but into the cosmic nature itself. It descended into the Earth. It was exactly this. Even when achieved, the individual change will have a permanent and cosmic significance only if the individual becomes a center and a sign for the establishment of the supramental consciousness force and as an overtly operative power in the terrestrial workings of nature. In the same way in which thinking mind has been established through the human evolution as an overtly operative power in life and matter. So it counts for the cosmos, it counts for the individual consummation of the soul, if this stations itself and does not depart. This would mean the appearance in the evolution of a Gnostic being, a being of knowledge, or Purusha and a Gnostic Prakriti, a Gnostic nature. There must be an emergent supramental consciousness force liberated and active within the terrestrial whole and an organized supramental instrumentation of the spirit in the life and the body. For the body consciousness also must become sufficiently awake to be a fit instrument of the workings of the new supramental force and its new order. So you see here that the supramental consciousness is that which answers the question posed by all the yogas. It is the fuller knowledge than what one gets through jnana yoga. It is a greater love and beauty than what one receives through bhakti yoga. It is a greater effectivity in the world than what one receives and attains ordinarily through karma yoga. It is a greater fulfillment all the way into the cells of the body than what is achieved in hatha yoga or siddha yoga. Because it answers every question. This is why we must proceed to the next stage of evolution. We must greaten our consciousness into this supramental awareness. It's what we're looking for. It's what everyone is looking for. Till then, any intermediate change could be only partial or insecure. An overmind or intuitive instrumentation of nature could be developed, but it would be a luminous formation imposed on a fundamental and environmental inconscience. A supramental principle and its cosmic operation, once established permanently on its own basis, the intervening powers of overmind and spiritual mind could found themselves securely upon it and reach their own perfection. They would become, in the earth existence, a hierarchy of states of consciousness rising out of mind and physical life to the supreme spiritual level. There you have a staircase leading upwards to the sublime. Mind and mental humanity would remain as one step in the spiritual evolution, but other degrees above it would be there, formed and accessible, by which the embodied mental being, as it became ready, could climb into the gnosis and change into an embodied supramental and spiritual being. On this basis, the principle of a divine life in terrestrial nature would be manifested. Even the world of ignorance and inconscience might discover its own submerged secret and begin to realize in each lower degree its divine significance. So we see above the Gnostic being noted. We see in the closing sentences, divine life, the next two chapters, the Gnostic being and the divine life are the last two chapters of the life divine. Yes, we have just a few pages more than 100 to go, and we finish this great philosophic tome, this revelation, this revelatory call to the future. Wonderful. And the full disclosure of the cosmic secret. Wondrous, wondrous. Adbhuta, adbhuta. So, dealing with the inconscience, dealing with death, we follow Savitri, she who incarnates the eternal light of the supermind, into Book 10, the Book of the Double Twilight, Canto 4, Savitri speaks. Thought crowds in masses, seized by one regard. All time is one body, space a single look. There is the Godhead's universal gaze, and there the boundaries of immortal mind. The line that parts and joins the hemispheres closes in on the labor of the gods, fencing eternity from the toil of time. In her glorious kingdom of eternal light, all ruler, ruled by none, the truth supreme, omnipotent, omniscient, and alone, in a golden country keeps her measureless house. In its corridor, she hears the tread that comes out of the unmanifest, never to return till the unknown is known and seen by men. Above the stretch and blaze of cosmic sight, above the silence of the wordless thought, formless creator of immortal forms, nameless, investitured with the name divine, transcending time's hours, transcending timelessness, the mighty mother sits in lucent calm and holds the eternal child upon her knees, attending the day when he shall speak to fate. There is the image of our future's hope. There is the sun for which all darkness waits. There is the imperishable harmony. The world's contradictions climb to her and are one. There is the truth of which the world's truths are shreds. The light of which the world's ignorance is the shade, till truth draws back the shade that it has cast, the love our hearts call down to heal all strife, the bliss for which the world's derelict sorrows yearn. Thence comes the glory sometimes seen on earth, the visits of Godhead to the human soul, the beauty and the dream on nature's face. There the perfection born from eternity calls to it the perfection born in time, the truth of God surprising human life, the image of God overtaking finite shapes. There, in a world of everlasting light, in the realms of the immortal supermind, truth who hides here her head in mystery, her riddle deemed by reason impossible, in the stark structure of material form, unenigmaed lives, unmasked her face, and there is nature and the common law of things. There, in a body made of spirit stuff, the hearthstone of the ever-living fire, action translates the movements of the soul, thought steps infallible and absolute, and life is a continual worship's rite, a sacrifice of rapture to the One. A cosmic vision, a spiritual sense, feels all the infinite lodged in finite form, and seen through a quivering ecstasy of light, discovers the bright face of the bodiless. In the truth of a moment, in the moment's soul, can sip the honey wine of eternity. A spirit who is no one and innumerable, the one mystic infinite person of his world, multiplies his myriad personality. On all his bodies seals his divinity's stamp, and sits in each, immortal and unique. The immobile stands behind each daily act, a background of the movement and the scene, upholding creation on its might and calm, and change on the immutable's deathless poise. The timeless looks out from the traveling hours. The ineffable puts on a robe of speech where all its words are woven like magic threads, moving with beauty, inspiring with their gleam, and every thought takes up its destined place, recorded in the memory of the world. The truth supreme, vast and impersonal, fits faultlessly the hour and circumstance, its substance, a pure gold ever the same, but shaped into vessels for the Spirit's use. Its gold becomes the wine jar and the vase. All there is a supreme epiphany. The all-wonderful makes a marvel of each event. The all-beautiful is a miracle in each shape. The all-blissful smites with rapture the heart's throbs. A pure celestial joy is the use of sense. Each being there is a member of the self, a portion of the million-thoughted all, a claimant to the timeless unity, the many's sweetness, the joy of difference, edged with the intimacy of the One. Namaste. Jai Ma.